Presenting this third Thursday luncheon of the Kansas City Lawyers Division of the Federalist Society. This is probably one of our larger turnouts, so let me take a brief moment to say a few words about what the Federalist Society is. The Federalist Society is dedicated to the principles of freedom through limited government, of separation of powers under the Constitution, and dedicated to interpreting the law as it is, not as we might wish it to be. Those are the principles of the Federalist Society. If you're interested in those principles or how they work out, this is a group for you. We hope you'll continue to come if you're interested in those principles. We meet every third Thursday here at Chapels. We'd love to see you in the future. The Federalist Society is not a political organization. We have Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, nonprofit. We don't endorse candidates, but we do occasionally like to hear from office holders that have interesting things to say about the issues we are interested in. Which leads us to our speaker today. Many of you know him, all of you are aware of him. Many years ago, I had the pleasure of meeting him at Southwest Baptist University. I was a young college student. He was just beginning a career in elective office. I think there were about 10 college students there. He's gone on to hold much higher office and fill much larger rooms. That's why we're thrilled he can take time today to talk to us and this group of lawyers and interested persons. Please give a warm welcome to Governor Matt Blunt, Governor of the State of Missouri.
It's still on.
There we go. It's still on.
All right. I hope everybody will let me know if they can or can't hear what I have to say. I do want to thank you for the opportunity, though, to visit with members of the Federalist Society. And certainly it's important to have an active Federalist Society, I believe, in our state. For more than 20 years, the Federalist Society, as you all know, has sought to return the judiciary to the limited role that was envisioned by our founding fathers. They've done that through democratic means, through scholarship and sponsoring debates and trying to really have a prompt discussion about the role of the judiciary and what the appropriate role would be. Certainly, the efforts of the Federalist Society to impact the debate and the discussion in the courts have been effective. I think it's safe to say that the Federalist Society had a hand in the confirmation of Chief Justice John Roberts, Justice Samuel Alito, just to name a few, dozens of others, highly qualified appointees to the federal courts. And it's good to see a resurgent interest in the Federalist Society in our state, with the chapters in St. Louis and, of course, here in Kansas City. Changing hearts and minds at the state level is just as important as change at the federal level. Of course, the success, I think, of the Federalist Society shouldn't come as a surprise to any of us. The Society's founding principles are consistent with the vision of our founding fathers and the beliefs of the American public. These principles are that, first, the state exists to preserve freedom. Second, that the separation of government powers is central to our Constitution. And third, that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what the law should be. Those are pretty sound principles upon which to build an organization. Certainly in a democratic society, the role of the judiciary is necessarily limited. It's limited to saying what the law is, not what it should be. To go beyond this role is to negate the democratic process. I want to talk today a little bit about this basic concept, the role of the judiciary, and how the judicial branch should be anchored in its foundation, and the importance that I place upon appointing judges who will remain faithful to the words of the Constitution rather than the whims of their own personal preference or prejudice. Despite its successes, certainly the Federalist Society has much work left to do. I think it would be safe to say the American public is more likely to agree with the views of Chief Justice Roberts than other justices, but there are liberals who believe in the active liberty philosophy of Justice Stephen Breyer. Breyer's followers do not believe the Constitution was formed to preserve freedom, but instead to promote active liberty. In other words, they don't believe the Constitution is a document that limits government power, thereby preserving individual freedom. Instead, they believe the Constitution merely channels power through the democratic process. This belief, of course, is antithetical to the clear intention that's of our founding fathers. For them, the Constitution is not a set of rules, not the fathers, but those who believe in active liberty. It's not a set of rules only changeable through the formal amendment process, the Constitution is alive and always changing. And it's the judge's role to define where it should go next. And of course, that's not the vision that our founders had. Many liberals are not shy about what this means for judicial interpretation. An Act of Liberty, which is Breyer's short book on judicial interpretation, he declares that judges should reconstruct past solutions imaginatively and project the purposes which inspired past solutions to reach a decision. Imagination and inspiration certainly are powerful words, and they're wonderful for poets and for artists. They're not necessarily good for judges, for whom they are an open invitation to substitute their personal preferences for the actual words and meanings of the statute and Constitution. Proponents of imaginative judicial interpretation confuse the role of the legislature and the judicial branch. And legislatures can use tools like imagination and inspiration and ideology in deciding what the law should be. Judges, however, imaginative and inspired they may be, should merely say what the law is. There obviously are tremendous consequences to this, and a failure to stick to the very clear direction provided in the Constitution. You can enumerate lots of them. One example that I thought was powerful was the decision in Kelo versus New London, where the courts clearly abrogated a constitutional right and protecting private property. And you go on, I think, and name other things. Skeptics might still question whether a living constitution really has dire consequences for democratic government. And U.S., I think, Missouri history proves those skeptics wrong. There are drastic consequences. In 1846, Dred Scott, in a case that you're all very familiar with, a resident of St. Louis and former slave, sued for his freedom in Missouri court, and he won. And actually, it was not all that uncommon for slaves to win in slave freedom cases. In 1848, the Missouri Supreme Court ruled in Dred Scott's favor, giving Scott and his family their freedom. Unfortunately, the decision did not hold. Just 2 years later, as many of you know, the Missouri Supreme Court revisited the case, ruling the second time around that Scott was still a slave. The second decision overturned previous Missouri case law holding that slaves taken into free states were automatically free. Dred Scott appealed, of course, to the United States Supreme Court, but lost again. A 7-2 majority held that all African Americans, slave and free, were forever prohibited from becoming United States citizens. The decision had no basis in constitutional law or American history. At the time of the ratification, African Americans could vote in 10 of 13 states, and there was nothing in the Constitution in 1857 to prevent citizenship of freed slaves. The judges were merely following the active liberty philosophy by constructing their own imaginative solution upon the social problem of slavery. In a very stirring dissent, Justice Benjamin Curtis lambasted the majority's constitutional opinion. Curtis wrote, "When a strict interpretation of the Constitution," and this could be something that a member of the Federalist Society would repeat today, "when a strict interpretation of the Constitution, according to the fixed rules which govern the interpretations of laws, is abandoned, and the theoretical opinions of individuals are allowed to control its meaning, we no longer have a Constitution. We're under a government of individual men, who for the time being have power to declare what the Constitution is according to their own views of what it ought to mean." Justice Curtis did the unthinkable a year later and actually resigned from the court under protest. I believe the only time that that's ever occurred. Interestingly, as a side note, Justice Curtis, who I don't know a lot about, but certainly from what I do know, is a very admirable person, reminds us how important the appointment process can be. He was appointed by Millard Fillmore, who is sort of a symbol of mediocrity amongst our presidents. But he appointed this very noble and a heroic person to the court, and a person who's obviously provided a good example. We all know about the national consequences, of course, of that decision, certainly it led in many ways to the Civil War. Of course, there's no current Supreme Court to controversy that engenders as much strife as the evils of slavery, yet Justice Curtis' dissent remains relevant today. In reality, as Curtis explained, a living Constitution is actually a dead one, for the actual text of the Constitution no longer matters. What matters instead are imaginative and inspirational policy preferences of unrestrained judges. This is neither what our founders intended, nor what voters expect from the judicial branch. Certainly the Missouri Supreme Court is not immune to judicial overreach. Just last year, the court struck down a voter identification law, which was substantially similar to an Arizona law that was upheld by the United States Supreme Court, supported by a vast majority of Missourians. In December, the court ruled that Planned Parenthood could keep nearly $1 million it had received from state coffers in clear violation of Missouri's very clear ban on abortion funding. Just a few months ago, the court overturned 60 years of precedent to invent a state constitutional right to collective bargaining for government employees. That court should have ruled on more limited grounds. Even the dissenting justices agreed that the teachers' union should have prevailed in their contract dispute with the Independent School Board. But instead of issuing a narrow ruling, the court invented a new constitutional right. In essence, the court declared that it was in a better position to divine voter intent 60 years after the fact than justices sitting on the court just 2 years after the adoption of the collective bargaining provision of our state constitution. As I see it, there are two solutions to the problem and two things that we should focus on doing. The first solution is to pass laws and constitutional provisions to protect the Constitution and the separation of powers. And the second solution, of course, is the systematic, to make certain that appointees to the Missouri bench understand the differences between the roles of judges and legislator. A judge's job is to say what the law is, not what the law should be. Preemptive laws are sometimes necessary. Passing new laws to protect against future judicial overreach is nothing new to Missouri. In 2004, Missourians voted overwhelmingly to protect traditional marriage from judges with a personal agenda to legalize gay marriage. Critics then claimed that amendment was not necessary. But as they'd seen in other states, Missourians thought it was necessary to protect traditional marriage and define what marriage should be within the Constitution rather than allowing the judge to do it for them. I think we have another potential opportunity to constrain the courts. That's why I was supportive of House Joint Resolution Number 1, which simply states, and I'll read the text, "Under no circumstances shall a court of this state order the General Assembly to increase taxes or create new taxes. The appropriation of state revenues is the exclusive province of the General Assembly." One might think something so simple would not be that controversial, but after all, we thought the issue of which branch levied taxes and ordered spending had been settled in 1787. Some opponents claim that H.J.R. 1 is unnecessary because no Missouri court has ever imposed a tax hike or usurped the legislature's power of appropriation. Lawyers in Kansas and Nevada could have said the same thing 5 years ago, yet their Supreme Court still issued decisions that I believed infringe upon the traditional roles of the elected branch of government. Just across the state line, the Kansas court ordered the legislature to spend at least $287 million more dollars on education, a number it derived from a report issued by an out-of-state consulting group. In Nevada, the state Supreme Court told the state legislature to ignore the state's equivalent of the Hancock Amendment and to enact the largest tax increase in that state's history. H.J.R. 1 would help prevent those types of things from happening in Missouri by doing nothing more than affirming what I believe, and many say they believe, is current law. Opponents, however, have reacted with alarm and inconsistent arguments. On the one hand, they claim that House Joint Resolution Number 1 is not necessary, and on the other, they claim that it intrudes upon judicial independence. But how could H.J.R. 1 be harmful for ensuring that Missouri judges do not seize power that they do not have, and that the bar claims they would never use? Missourians support checks and balances. It's time to ask the people to state plainly that unelected judges will not tax and spend from the bench as they've done in other states. H.J.R. 1 would help protect one of America's cornerstones. Taxation without representation is unacceptable to free people. While things like H.J.R. 1 can make an impact, a systematic solution can be found, of course, in the appointment process. With a soon-to-be vacant seat on the Missouri Supreme Court, my administration will hopefully have an opportunity to appoint a jurist to the Missouri Supreme Court who understands the proper role of the judicial branch. I think, as you all know, and I'll just briefly glaze over because I would imagine virtually everybody in the room understands how judges are selected in Missouri, governors have a limited role. Nominations are made by a Judicial Selection Committee, composed of the Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court, 3 members selected by the Missouri Bar Association, and 3 members selected by the governor. I've appointed 1 of those 3 members, so 1 of the 7 that will submit a list of names to me after they've interviewed candidates and agreed upon 3 nominees. And then the governor chooses amongst those nominees, and if the governor refuses, the commission chooses instead. I'm certainly hopeful that the Appellate Judicial Commission will respect Missourians by putting forth a slate of nominees who, if selected, would dutifully interpret our Constitution and statutes without regard to their own policy preferences. I think when given a choice, Missourians have shown that they want qualified, honest judges who will faithfully interpret the Constitution over judges with a personal agenda. And that's precisely the type of judge that I'm calling upon the Appellate Judicial Commission to nominate. This judge will not just give lip service to the Federalist Society's principles. This judge will actually practice them. When faced with any case, my ideal candidate would ask 2 questions. 1, what is the law? And 2, how does the law apply to this case? He or she would not ask, what is the effect of the law? They would not ask if they think it's a good policy. Nor would he or she resort to imagination or inspiration outside the actual words and text of the Constitution, state statutes, or legal precedent. Voters elect legislators and governors to make these policy choices, not judges. The limited role of the judiciary was best described by Chief Justice Roberts in his confirmation hearing before the United States Senate. Roberts compared judges to umpires. Judges and justices are servants of the law, not the other way around, Roberts says. Judges, he continued, are like umpires. They don't make the rules. They apply them. They make sure everybody plays by the rules. That's a limited role. Nobody ever went to a ball game to see the umpire. He went on to promise that as a Supreme Court justice, he would remember that a judge's job is to call balls and strikes, not to pitch or bat. The next nominee to the Missouri Supreme Court should be capable of making that same promise and repeating those same words. Missouri voters elect legislators and governors to do the pitching and the batting. They expect judges to stay out of the fray. It's only reasonable, then, to expect the Appellate Judicial Commission to nominate a Missouri version of Chief Justice Roberts, an intelligent, but grounded man or woman of principle who realizes that judges must remain modest if they're to fulfill their proper constitutional roles. The nominee must realize that their role as a judge is not to become an inspired advocate of advanced social theory, but merely a faithful adherent to the rule of law, a cherished principle in our democratic society, and one eloquently condensed in the Federalist Society's 3rd principle, which I'll repeat again. It is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. I fully hope and expect that the Appellate Judicial Commission will take the will of Missourians into account and nominate this type of judge. As I mentioned, I'm very thrilled to see greater involvement, engagement by the Federal Society in our state. I think it's very helpful to the process. It's made a tremendous difference across our nation. And I'd be happy to answer questions that you all might have for me. Does somebody moderate those questions, John Hilton? Okay. All right, thank you. Thank you, John. Thanks. I think it goes, it moves around.